When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Michael de Groot about his book titled Disruption, The Global Economic Shocks of the 1970s and the End of the Cold War, just out in 2024 from Cornell University Press. And this book is really interesting because it takes something, two things that we think we know, and kind of puts them together in an interesting way: the global economic upheavals of the 1970s and, of course, the end of the Cold War, making the argument that these things are perhaps more related than we might otherwise give them credit for. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself and especially why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of international studies at Indiana University, and I came to this project for a few reasons. The first is that the 1970s, when I started this project, was on the cutting edge of the declassification process in archives in the United States as well as Europe. And when I got into the archives, I expected to find material on the Cold War where the major policymakers would be thinking about things such as detente, the arms race, traditional things with which we typically associate the Cold War. But as I got further into the materials, I began to realize that really the core of their preoccupations was on dealing with global economic upheaval During the 1970s. And what really surprised me was the extent to which the conversations taking place in Western capitals was not that different from the conversations taking place in the Soviet bloc. And as I thought about what this might mean for our understanding of late 20th century international history, I began to realize that the 1970s serving somewhat of a hinge. In other words, that the Cold War that we associate with the 1950s and 1960s, where you have two independent blocs based around antagonistic ideologies and ways of organizing political economy, social structure, world order, that world, that Cold War, had fundamentally transformed by the time we get to the 1980s, where the United States is ascendant because it's able to draw on global resources. And not only was the Soviet bloc confronting an ascendant West, but it was also becoming dependent on, for its very survival, on Western credits, products, and so on. So I wanted to figure out, why did the 1970s create this new type of relationship? And I was also finally thinking about this topic in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, with which capitalism was able to endure, although transformed in some pretty significant ways. And I began to draw some parallels in the 1970s when people also talked a lot about the potential that capitalism would not be able to survive. And I wanted to go back to the 1970s as a way of understanding my current moment.
What an interesting mix of reasons to work on this project. And of course, as a fellow historian, I love the idea that it starts with being surprised by what you found in the archives. That's in fact something I'd like to have you tell us a little bit further about. Not just surprising the archives, but obviously to some extent, this is making an surprise intervention in the literature as well, given this new information. So could you tell us a bit about the intervention you're making and maybe more about the kinds of sources you found to do this?
Well, the primary argument for the book is that the key to understanding why the Cold War ended lies in the West's ability and Soviet bloc's inability to adapt to the global economic shocks of the 1970s. And by global economic shocks of the 70s, I'm referring to things such as the exhaustion of the economic growth models on both sides of the Iron Curtain, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, upheaval in the commodities markets, stagflation in the West, and stagnation in the Soviet bloc. And so what I'm trying to do is expand the timeline for how we understand the end of the Cold War, which is typically literature on this subject typically begins in the mid-1980s. But I'm pushing the chronology back and looking at what I see is truly the key decade of change, the 1970s. And the case here is not to say that the end of the Cold War was monocausal and certainly not inevitable. But in a causal hierarchy, the claim is that the impact of the global economic shocks of the 70s needs to go at the very top. And I think that taking this framework allows us to look at the end of the Cold War in a few different ways. So I think that to the extent that a consensus exists in the literature, it would emphasize the agency of Mikhail Gorbachev for bringing a new intellectual framework to Soviet foreign policy and being the key agent that helped bring the Cold War to a close. But my framework, which looks at the structural changes of the 1970s and the ways in which it contributed to the economic and political atrophy that ultimately, in my view, caused the Soviet bloc to collapse, we see Gorbachev not necessarily as the key driver of change, but a reinforcing, a secondary actor. And I also think that at the end of the Cold War, you really need to explain two things. You need to explain why the Soviet bloc collapsed. But the other part, which I think receives a lot less attention, is you have to explain why the West was able to endure. Why was it how do you explain that the dog did not bark, in other words? And my answer to it is in the West's ability to adapt to the global economic shocks of the 70s, to reignite non-inflationary growth. And I'm also hoping that this can contribute to understanding of how we got to the international political economy that supports the U.S. system of alliances today, one in which the United States still has sprawling geopolitical responsibilities, and one that's undergirded by international political economy in which American power is underwritten by the inflow of foreign capital. And then finally, I would say that this book is based on archival research in Europe, the United States, and Russia. And so I'm hoping, and a lot of these documents, particularly from Bulgarian archives and Russian archives, will appear in the book for the first time. So I'm hoping that this book is also seen as a contribution to a historical literature based on recently declassified evidence.
All right. Well, that's a very helpful overview of what you're doing and how you're doing it. I'd love to then get into the details of the argument that you're making. And I think we probably want to go back before the 1970s to understand kind of just how pivotal that decade was. So you place the book, you start in the first few decades of the Cold War before we get to the 1970s. Can you tell us what you mean by the term welfare empire and perhaps do a bit of compare and contrast of the US version and the USSR version in that time period?
Sure. Well, welfare empire is one of the mechanisms with which I make the overall argument. And what I mean by welfare empire is simply a structure of alliances in which resources flow from the superpowers to the allies. And this is a concept which integrates elements of not just economics, but also ideology and very expansive conceptions of national security in Moscow and Washington that drew on the perceived lessons of the Great Depression as well as the Second World War. In the U.S. case, this expansive conception of national security comes from the primary lesson, as Mel Leffler reminds us, that a totalitarian power must never again seize control over Eurasia. If that were to happen, then the United States would be forced to become a garrison state. So the policy prescription of this lesson was that the United States must tie Western Europe and Japan tightly to the United States and build and help build popular support for democracy, as well as capitalism. And so, in order to achieve this broad objective, the U.S. accepted certain disadvantages in the economic architecture. The United States, for example, its dollar was fixed at a constant rate of $35 per ounce. Which meant that other currencies, which would be fixed to the dollar but could adjust based on their needs, they could devalue their currency and make their exports more competitive. But the United States could not. The United States accepted trade discrimination from its allies. It also, of course, served as the guarantor of Western security. And it could do this because of the strength of its because of its financial strength as well as its manufacturing superiority. And throughout this period, despite those disadvantages, the U.S. was a net creditor as well as ran a pretty large trade surplus. And we see, and again, this was, I think, quite surprising to me, that there's a similar system that emerges in the Soviet bloc by about the 1950s. Between the end of the Second World War and up until maybe Stalin's death, the Soviet Union notoriously plundered Eastern Europe, particularly East Germany. But after that, the flow of resources switched to look a lot more like it did in the U.S. case. And the Soviet Union, of course, served as the military guarantor of the Soviet bloc, helped rescue Eastern European communist regimes, particularly in 1956 and 1968. It accepted an international trade system which overvalued manufactured goods, which were the primary, which primarily came from Eastern Europe, and undervalued its commodities coming from the Soviet Union. And so you see some, of course, enormous ideological differences, but in terms of the flow of resources, we see some commonality. We also see commonality in terms of both blocs' fixation on economic growth as a source of legitimacy to build domestic support for their ideologies, to invest in the military-industrial complex, to implement visions of world order. So these welfare empires actually worked fairly well in the first part of the decade. And this comes, of course, with a qualification that in the West, alliance management tended to involve negotiation, whereas in the East, in the Soviet bloc, there was often more the Soviet Union dictating to its allies. But broadly speaking, I think we can see the two as parallel structures. And of course, the book picks up when these parallel structures entered crisis at almost precisely the same moment in the long 1970s.
Well, let's go then to the first of these shocks, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. What problems of this US welfare empire that you've just described to us, what problems does it reveal? And how did the US and its allies try to respond kind of in the immediate short term?
Well, to start off, the Bretton Woods was a series of overlapping institutions designed to govern the rules of international trade and promote economic growth. And the problem inherent in the system was it was a system designed to reflect the correlation of power that existed in the 1940s, but by the late 1960s, early 1970s, that no longer existed. It presumed an American industrial and financial superiority, as I already mentioned, the $35 per ounce relationship between the dollar and gold was the linchpin of this. And when the United States held the majority of the world's gold, that made a lot of sense. But Bretton Woods became a victim of its own success as its allies in Western Europe and Japan earned more gold through the growth of their exports. And simultaneously, as the so-called euro markets, offshore financial markets, grew in strength, they began to look at different fixed parities and bet on which one didn't match up to reality. So in the international sphere, we see the relative decline of American power and the relative growth of Western European and Japanese power, placing stress on a system that had presumed American power. And the second place where we see this is that the Bretton Woods system had helped promote non-inflationary growth across the industrial democracies. But now, because the growth model was exhausting itself, he began to see inflation ticking up, unemployment ticking up. So both internationally and domestically, this welfare empire system in which the Bretton Woods system is a key piece of the architecture, both coming under stress. And so it's what you see in the early 1970s is policymakers reacting to what seem to be inexorable forces that they can't really control and don't completely understand. So you see a series of improvised solutions. So first one maybe to point out would be the Smithsonian Agreement, which comes in December of 1971, just a few months after Nixon infamously shut the gold window in August of 1971. And this involved a currency realignment in which most of the Western European and the Japanese yen in particular, because the most worrying U.S. trade deficit was with Japan, those currencies revalued, whereas the U.S. dollar devalued from $35 to $38 per ounce as a means of trying to increase American export competitiveness. You also see a lot of anxiety on the Western European side about what the future of the American dollar was. So part of the reason that American monetary integration had a burst of interest in the early 1970s was precisely because nobody knew what was really going to happen with the U.S. dollar. And the Western Europeans turned to European integration as a potential solution to that problem. But as I already mentioned, with the resurgence of global finance, attempts of the European community to create what was called the snake, in which the currencies would all, the European currencies would all have fixed relations with each other. Global financialization kicked Britain out of this system by June of 1972, and the snake would lose members, particularly as we get further on into the oil crisis. So the end result by 1973 is that economies are running very hot. Economic growth is still fairly high before the oil crisis, but inflation and unemployment are becoming big problems. The Bretton Woods system had already collapsed, and nobody really knows what's going to replace it. And so there's a lot of uncertainty.
And it's not just on this side of the Iron Curtain. You talked about earlier that both welfare empires come under strain roughly at the same time. So what's going on the Soviet side in the early 1970s? And what did their initial responses look like?
Well, just as we saw on the Western side with the exhaustion of the economic growth model, we're seeing something very similar in the case of Soviet socialism. Soviet socialism was actually doing fairly well in the 1950s and 1960s if we look at just the economic growth rates. Of course, the quality of that growth left a lot to be desired, but in quantitative terms, Soviet socialism was quite good at achieving what's called extensive growth, which refers to economic growth achieved by increasing the inputs into the economy. And the command economy is quite good at allocating resources. And there was also an opportunity to achieve this growth because the bloc had been destroyed by the Second World War. So Reconstruction offered opportunities for economic growth, as did the drive to industrialize agrarian societies. But at a certain point, there are no more idle resources to throw into manufacturing, no endless reserves of people living in the countryside also to throw into the factories. So just as we saw in the West, we see a petering out of this economic growth model. And planners tried to tinker with this in the 1960s, introducing some liberalization, very small measures of market mechanisms into the economy. But what the Prague Spring showed in 1968 was that there's a limit to how much tinkering you could actually do. And for Prague Spring reformers, there was a belief that in order to reform economically, you also needed to reform politically. And the Soviet Union, along with some of its other allies, saw Soviet socialism under threat by that way of thinking and intervened in the Prague Spring in 1968. So that shut the door, so to speak, on reform communism. And just to take a step back, this economic problem, we shouldn't see this as simply an economic problem. There are very large political, social, and geopolitical stakes, because there's a very clear link that Soviet policymakers identified between material prosperity and regime stability. So one big problem for the Soviet welfare empire is that their economic growth model is kind of running out of steam. And also the subsidy, which I had mentioned a little bit earlier, in which manufactured goods were overpriced and raw materials were underpriced, this subsidy began to get a lot larger as the upheaval in the commodity markets began to make itself known in the early 1970s, even before the big 1973 oil shock. So the response behind the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe was to turn to debt-led development. And from our perspective, this seems like a crazy, foolish idea. But for policymakers who believed ultimately in its success, it made a lot of sense. And so this debt-led development strategy involved taking out loans from capitalist banks in order to pay for imports of technology, consumer goods. They also expected to be able to continue to draw on cheap raw materials from the Soviet Union. And by this point, the Soviet Union beginning to resent how the Eastern Europeans expected cheap raw materials to come to them. And the expectation was you combine both of these elements, organize it within a socialist model, and the new industries would be able to produce goods that the West would want to buy. Eastern Europeans would earn hard currency from those exports and then in turn pay off the debt. So this is a big bet that this system would work. And of course, the tragedy for them is that it didn't. And they ended up just falling deeper and deeper into debt. And the further the debt rose, the harder it was ultimately going to be to dig out of the hole. So this is really a key moment when the Eastern Europeans turned to debt-led development as a way of trying to solve the broader economic growth problem.
Which is definitely an interesting thing to think about. I mean, in some senses, we knew both of these pieces, or we knew some of both of these pieces, but putting them together kind of really reveals, hang on a second, they're both quite under strain. And that's before we get to perhaps what we might think of the big shock of the 1970s, which is, of course, the 1973 oil crisis. Classic analyses often point to, obviously, the US and its allies as being the prime actors that struggle from this. And in some senses, that sometimes kind of not quite lets the Soviet Union off the hook, but a little bit. The emphasis is certainly not there. What do you think? To what extent would you take a claim like the Soviet Union being even a beneficiary of the oil shock? How might you assess that?
Yeah. Well, that's certainly the conventional wisdom. That the Soviet Union was a net beneficiary. And it's outwardly, the reasoning makes a lot of sense. The Soviet Union, by the mid-1970s, was the world's largest oil producer, large exporter of oil, and it earned a windfall of hard currency. So when I got to the archives in Russia, I expected this was the story that I was going to be able to see. But the archives revealed a very different picture. And instead of basking in energy abundance, as we would have expected, the Soviet Union, and particularly its Eastern European allies, were talking a lot more about shortages. It's not that the Soviet Union had a number of different groups that it needed to think about. It not only had to supply itself, it not only had to export to the West for hard currency, but it also had to think about its informal empire in Eastern Europe, which was also really dependent on Soviet oil in order to make this debt-led development strategy work. And so what we see is Eastern Europe gets absolutely pummeled by the oil crisis. And because the Soviet Union's broad conception of its own national security involves stability in Eastern Europe, that necessarily hurt the Soviet Union as well. So in the book, I describe what I call the twin oil crises, which confront the Soviet bloc. The first one is that even though the Soviet Union provide the lion's share of of oil to Eastern Europe outside of Romania, which was an oil producer on its own. It's a 10 to 20%, depending on which country we're talking about, in Eastern Europe still had to go to countries outside of the Soviet Union in order to get the rest of its energy balance. So principally friendly countries in the Middle East. And they had to pay market prices for this. So just at the same time that they're going deep into debt to capitalist banks, they have to go deeper into debt in order to pay for the oil, the 10 to 20% of their energy, of their oil balance coming from the non-socialist world. And the second crisis is that the Soviet Union began to insist, and I think this is a really key moment, began to insist on higher prices for its oil sales to Eastern Europe. Because the way that the prices worked in the Soviet bloc was according to what was called the Bucharest formula. And the Bucharest formula, very simply, was trying to involved fixing price trade prices among the Comecon countries for 5 years based on a world market average of the previous 5 years. So it tries to use, based on this world market average, it tries to draw on conditions in global capitalism to simulate the cost of production while fixing prices to ensure that disruptions in the capitalist world wouldn't impact long-term planning within the Soviet bloc. And this formula, because it fixed prices before the shock, meant that they were selling oil to the Eastern Europeans at a small fraction after the oil shock of what they could be getting on the world market. And you can see this resentment about how much the Soviet Union was subsidizing Eastern Europe at this stage really bubble to the surface and them demanding more oil coming from more oil to that they're selling to Eastern Europe. Another key piece of the puzzle as to why they're demanding more higher prices is that there's a growing divergence between the production costs in the Soviet Union and the very low prices that they're demanding, that they're getting from Comecon. The center of Soviet oil production in the 1970s is shifting from the Volga-Ural region into Western Siberia. Western Siberia is a much more unforgiving terrain. It's far from consumers in the western part of the country and in Eastern Europe. And the technical challenges get a lot bigger. So the Soviets are looking at the situation and saying, we need to stop subsidizing as much as we have been previously. For Eastern Europe, this is an absolute disaster, because not only have they cast their die, so to speak, in the early 1970s by insisting on debt-led development, now not only do they have to pay more to the West in order to finance the same amount of oil, now the Soviet Union is demanding more for its oil. And so the only way that they can stay afloat and continue to work the system is to take on even more debt and subsidize their economic growth by getting credits from the West. And this was a system from which this was a trap from which they're never able to get out.
Hmm. Okay. So this is not looking good then for either side of the Iron Curtain. Let's talk then about kind of the longer term responses, because they really diverge in a lot of ways at this point. You talk about the US welfare empire under all of this strain, taking these short term actions, then becoming inverted in the late 1970s and early 1980s. What do you mean by that, and what enabled this change?
Yeah, the inverted welfare empire refers to a structure in contrast to what we saw during the first part of the Cold War, where the United States disseminated resources to its allies. By the 1980s, this flow of resources had completely transformed. Now the United States had become dependent on the inflow of resources from its allies. And this relationship was completely unplanned. Some of it had to do with the long-term relative decline of American competitiveness. So the United States ran its first trade deficit in 1971, the first since the 1890s. But the system, this inverted welfare model, really crystallizes under Reagan during his first terms. And it comes about because of an unintended cocktail, if you like, of policies. Confronting the challenges of stagflation when Ronald Reagan came into office in January of 1981, for him, the solution was easy. Get the government out of the economy, slash taxes. He also wanted to increase defense spending. Congress insisted on protecting social programs. And so despite Reagan's claim that cutting taxes would ultimately help close the budget deficit, the opposite was true. And the Reagan administration, the one who claimed that it was going to close the budget deficits, actually, as he put it in a moment of self-reflection in his diary, the Reagan administration was the one who created the biggest budget deficits of them all. And so simultaneous to this, to Reagan's fiscal policy, the Federal Reserve also keeping interest rates at historic highs as a means of trying to get inflation under control. And the way that these two strategies came together help create or accelerate the emergence of the welfare empire. So the way that these two work together is that the Reagan administration running massive budget deficits, the Federal Reserve understood that not only did it need to keep interest rates high as a means of suppressing inflation, but it also needed to keep interest rates high as a way of attracting foreign capital that could in turn help finance the budget deficits. And you see policymakers in the Treasury also in the early 1980s beginning to see this relationship. And there's a concerted effort by Don Regan and his staff to try to liberalize capital markets abroad as a way of making foreign savings available for investment in the United States. Another key part of this puzzle, so as interest rates are high, the dollar also appreciates during the early 1980s and becomes very, very strong. And with a very strong dollar, American consumers had a really insatiable appetite for cheap foreign products. And this is something that encouraged very large trade deficits for the United States. It pummeled American exporters and contributed to the long-term decline of American labor and American labor protections. So again, the new system is one in which the United States is running both very large trade deficits, and it had also become a net importer of capital at some point in the mid to late 1980s, depending on which source you consult. But the important thing to notice here is that this is, again, not just an economic change, but this is one that has supreme geopolitical importance. Because as the United States is running up these big budget deficits, part of it is in support of a $1.5 trillion military buildup, which can only go forward because of the inflow of foreign capital. American partners in Western Europe, and particularly in East Asia, are benefiting from the booming American market and its appetite for foreign products. So their economies get support from the American demand. There's an even larger trade surplus for Japan vis-a-vis the United States that had ever existed before. And the Western Europeans benefit broadly from exchange rate competitiveness. By the late 1980s, American policymakers, academics, and others are really grappling with the implications of this inverted welfare empire because it seems to cut both ways. On one hand, it allows the United States to continue waging the Cold War. But on the other hand, it has led to these twin deficits. It has hurt American laborers. And so you have these two different narratives at the late 1980s, just before the 1989 revolutions, about the future of American power. On one hand, you have proponents pointing to the resurgence of non-inflationary growth, growing American hard power as evidence that this is working. And then on other hands, you have people who are far more skeptical, people like Paul Kennedy, with his publication of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And his prediction, and just a few years before the Soviet Union itself would collapse, he identified the United States as the more likely superpower to fall into the trap of imperial overstretch. And so both of these narratives got some of the story right, which is quite which is quite an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, it definitely is an interesting phenomenon. Thank you for taking us through that. What then was the impact beyond the US? The impact, for example, with US allies, but also, of course, with the Soviet Union?
Well, the Volcker Shock itself was, of course, oriented toward domestic problems, oriented above all of trying to get the money supply under control and get inflation under control. But because of the outsized role of the American economy, the role of the U.S. dollar in international trade and global finance, what the Federal Reserve did and does still today, what the Federal Reserve did had global implications. And the Western Europeans in the early 1980s, this is a very low point in transatlantic relations. And Western European policymakers were howling at the Reagan administration, trying to get them to close the budget deficit because they saw the budget deficit as one of the reasons that interest rates had to be so high. And in order to compete with American interest rates, they also had to keep their interest rates higher than they wanted to. Of course, they had local reasons for why they should take a stronger monetary stand. But the pressure that the Federal Reserve placed on them meant that they were not able to expand their economies as much as they would like. But what I was really surprised about is that the Volcker Shock transcended the Iron Curtain and really delivered a body blow, so to speak, to the Soviet bloc. Because if we remember, the Soviet, the Eastern Europeans had turned to this debt-led development strategy in the early 1970s, doubled down on it in the mid-1970s, and had become, in the words of Stephen Kotkin, somewhat of a Ponzi scheme, whereby the only way they were able to keep the system afloat is by taking on new debt to pay the old. But what the Volcker Shock did was completely transform lending patterns and made taking out loans a lot more expensive than they would have been otherwise. And so the Volcker Shock quite simply precipitated a debt crisis in Eastern Europe, as well as, I should mention, even though it goes beyond the scope of the project, across the so-called Third World. And countries across Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa would suffer from major debt crises in the 1980s that had at least in part been precipitated by this transformation in interest rates. And in Eastern Europe, we can see most countries teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. So the famous solidarity movement, in which the Solidarity Independent Trade Union would compete for the loyalty of the Polish people between 1980 and 1981 with the Polish government. This has started because the Polish government recognizes that it cannot continue this debt-led development strategy, and they needed to suppress consumption as a way of regaining the confidence of international creditors. And during the solidarity crisis, the Polish policymakers are very clear about this. They understand how dependent their economy has become on Western creditors. The Soviet Union also understands how dependent it had become on Western markets and goods. And by late 1981, there's a consensus across the Soviet government that they can't afford to intervene in Poland to suppress the Solidarity Uprising. And this is a monumental moment, because if we look back at the history across the Soviet bloc, you have a series of Soviet interventions supported in some cases by Warsaw Pact member countries, but a series of events in which the Soviets deployed tanks as a way of suppressing local uprisings. But in Poland, there's a recognition that they can't do that anymore. They don't have the means. And if you invade Poland, even if it's successful, there's an expectation that the Polish army wasn't simply going to roll over for this. So the fight would be quite violent. But even if this were to succeed from the Soviet perspective, they still got to figure out what to do with the fact that the Polish economy is bleeding and de facto bankrupt. And so one of the arguments that I'm trying to make here is that this correlation of forces of rising debt, of Soviet weakness would reappear just on a much grander scale by the 1989 revolutions.
All right, so let's add to this, shall we? Because of course it's not complex enough already. Let's throw Gorbachev into this. What does he do to try and move beyond the welfare empire framework that, as you've just described, kind of has clearly sort of reached the limit of what it can do? And why wasn't he able to make the changes he wanted to?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to mention is that Gorbachev tried to move beyond, as you say, this welfare empire framework, but so too did most of his predecessors. And you can see Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko, all were complaining about the large burden that Eastern European was imposing on the Soviet Union, and all tried, with very little success, initiatives that they believed would shift the relationship between the two sides. Gorbachev, of course, went much further than the others. He signaled new departures in Soviet foreign policy, introduced ideas like the common European home, trying to bring the two European sides together, tried to treat Eastern European allies precisely as that, as more allies, to have a more democratic type of relationship. But regardless of these initiatives, there were certain structural problems that any Soviet leader, Soviet new thinking or otherwise, would have had to deal with. And principal among this would have been the problem of Eastern European debt. Any Soviet leader would have had to sit in 1989 in the Kremlin and pondered whether or not the Soviet Union could afford to do this, whether or not he believed in a more democratic way of organizing Soviet bloc relations. Gorbachev's initiatives also thwarted by the oil countershock in 1985, 1986, where prices fell in real terms, more or less back to where they had been in 1973. And additionally, along with the idea of the countershock, it's not just that the Soviet Union's earning fewer dollars for their oil, but the dollar depreciated in the second half of the 1980s. So the dollars that they are getting are worth far less than they were previously. So the Soviets are really getting pummeled by conditions in global oil. So just as we see, again, just to summarize, just even though we see initiatives in Soviet foreign policy that are legitimately new, Gorbachev's even calling Eastern Europe, the relationship between the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europeans as a form of slavery. And ultimately, he's not able to bring his very lofty and in some cases poorly conceived policies into being, because these structural forces just seem at this point inexorable.
Yeah, there definitely doesn't seem to be a lot to do given all of those constraints. It really makes us look at Gorbachev's ideas kind of in another light of, what made you think that this could work? And in fact, obviously, it doesn't. Gorbachev's policies don't pan out the way that he wants. And we do end up in a situation where, according to some analysts, at least, it might be framed as the West winning. But let's poke at that a little bit, I suppose. To what extent do you think the fact that the Soviet Union's kind of lost the ideological battle with the West, is that why the Soviet bloc collapsed?
Yeah. Well, it's an important question. I would say that the ideological battle was important, but it also wasn't a sufficient cause, because there are still today in places like North Korea and Cuba that are impoverished, authoritarian communist countries that demonstrate that there's nothing inherent in Marxism-Leninism that makes its collapse inevitable. You see reforms in places such as China and Vietnam that demonstrate that Marxism-Leninism can be reformable. So my answer to this is that it's an important but insufficient explanation. And in my view, the Soviet bloc was workable as a closed system. And that system no longer existed after the Eastern Europeans decided to pursue debt-led development in the early 1970s, because that gave a lever of sorts to the West to influence ideas, policymaking behind the Iron Curtain that they wouldn't have had otherwise. So just to give an example, if we were to compare the way that the Soviet leadership described the dangers of potential intervention in the 1968 Prague Spring versus the 1980-1981 Solidarity Crisis in Poland, in 1968, Soviet officials are concerned that an intervention could spark a conflict, an armed conflict with the West. There's nothing in those conversations about economic relations between the two sides. If we were to fast forward to solidarity in Poland, however, nobody's really thinking that an intervention in Poland would spark World War III, but they are absolutely terrified that an intervention would shut off Western capital markets, that they would not be able to import Western goods, and so on. So I think that the level of dependence that the East had found itself on the West by the late 1970s and into the 1980s played a crucial, crucial role. And the other part the other essential ingredient, I think, in the Soviet bloc's collapse, and by that I'm referring, of course, to Soviet hegemony over Eastern Europe, is Soviet weakness. And this is something that stems from long-term economic and political atrophy, the inflexibility of the Soviet socialist system, the inability to transition from extensive to intensive growth. And then, of course, the economy gets hit pretty hard by the oil countershock of 1985, 1986.
Yeah, so ideology is part of it, but not the whole thing here. So if we think about kind of where we got up to, helping understand the collapse, that obviously happened a few decades ago now, but does have some links to the present. Why do you argue that, quote, understanding the 1970s has never been so urgent?
Well, I think there are a few reasons for this. If we look at the political economy that we have today, where we have heightened inflation, even though it's coming down, we've had shocks in the commodities markets. Oil prices skyrocketed in particular in 2022. We have a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Russian have their second invasion of Ukraine in 2022. So there seems to be, particularly in popular discourse, a comparison to be made between the political economic conditions of the 1970s and the early 2020s. But I think that historical analogies tend to be useful not insofar as telling us why things are similar, but why things are different. And we can identify some pretty significant differences between these two eras. Unemployment, for example, is high in the 1970s as part of stagflation. But even though we have inflation in the 2020s, unemployment's actually fairly low. So I think that we do need to study the 1970s as a means of ensuring that we don't fall into traps of reaching for tempting historical analogies. And the other thing that I would say about why the 1970s matter is that in Russia, policymakers have embraced somewhat of a kind of a stab in the back myth that harkens back to the way the German nationalists explained the German defeat in the First World War, in which the Germans weren't defeated on the battlefield, but instead were betrayed by civilian saboteurs in the German government. Often this right-wing argument has an anti-Semitic flavor in the 1920s. I think that we can see something similar in the case of Russia in its explanation of why Soviet hegemony collapsed in Eastern Europe. In other words, it wasn't that the Soviet Union was defeated on the battlefield, but instead misguided idealistic policies of Mikhail Gorbachev ceded Eastern Europe to the West for nothing. And I think that by taking this more structural approach to the end of the Cold War, we're able to explain why this stab in the back myth doesn't really hold water. And in fact, the Soviet bloc was defeated on the Cold War battlefield because of the inflexibility, really, of the system that they had overseen for quite some time.
Definitely worth thinking about today. I do have one final question, though we've really kind of all the way caught up really with the present. And this always feels like a strange question to ask for books that have so recently come out. But I do want to know, now that this is done, might you have something that you're working on next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic that you'd like to preview?
Sure. Well, I've started very, very early work. I think I'm still catching my breath a little bit from this first project, but I've started work on a project that along the lines of the geoeconomics of containment, which I'm thinking about economic warfare, Western economic warfare against the Soviet Union, going back to the Bolshevik Revolution. And the end date is still to be determined, whether it's the collapse of the Soviet Union or maybe even all the way up to the present day. And I think that and this project is motivated in some cases because this first book is really fundamentally interested in the ways that the alliances and the blocs operated. And I didn't have the space really to talk about economic warfare between the two blocs. So I'd like to pick up that thread in the second project and look at the ways in which Western policymakers conceived how they might be able to inhibit progress in the Soviet military-industrial complex, stunt economic growth in the Soviet Union and its allies, and then the ways in which the Soviet Union tried to circumvent those sanctions for its own purpose. So this is a project that's of course still in its very, very early stage, but I'm excited to get started.
Well, it sounds very interesting. So if it does become a book eventually, maybe you can come back and tell us more about it. But in the meantime, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Disruption, The Global Economic Shocks of the 1970s and the End of the Cold War, just out from Cornell University Press. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.